Hey, know where we can score some haggis? It's still illegal to import haggis from Scotland, despite reports saying otherwise. There's been a ban on British beef and lamb since 1989, when mad cow disease was in the news. If you don't already know, haggis is made from sheep innards, heart, liver, lungs, and fat, which are mixed with spices and oatmeal and cooked in the sheep's stomach. American haggis lovers were elated last week when word spread that the ban might be lifted. Haggis producers in Edinburgh were pretty excited too. They were already salivating over potential sales to a U.S. market. But when the BBC contacted the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they said not so fast. Recently, several news articles have incorrectly stated that the U.S. will be relaxing or lifting its ban on Scottish haggis, a spokeswoman wrote the news organization. And while a review of the ban on beef and lamb is underway, there is no time frame for its completion. And there may be another barrier to importing haggis. Since 1971, the U.S. has banned all food made with lungs. So, until the day when real Scottish haggis comes to the U.S., we'll have to make do with scrapple.
When Alice Eve Cohen was 44, she rushed to the hospital for an emergency CAT scan. Her belly was swollen, and doctors thought it might be an abdominal tumor, a big one. The radiologist frowned at the images.
We did find something in you, Mrs. Cohen. You did? We found a baby. What? We found a baby. What? We found a baby in you. Congratulations, Mrs. Cohen.
That's the playwright and actress Alice Eve Cohen reading from her memoir, What I Thought I Knew. Until that moment, what she thought she knew was that she could never, ever get pregnant. Alice Eve Cohen joins us from our New York bureau. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
You were told you could never conceive a child. Why?
Well, when I was 30 years old, I actually wanted to become pregnant, but my period had stopped and I knew that I had been affected by being a DES daughter. My mother had taken diethylstilbestrol when she was pregnant with me.
Which is a synthetic estrogen.
Exactly. And as a result, I had a deformed uterus. And we went to a fertility specialist who said, well, first of all, you're never going to get pregnant on your own because your estrogen is so low. In fact, I'm going to put you on estrogen replacement therapy at this young age of 30. And secondly, you should never, ever attempt through fertility treatments to become pregnant because the outcome would be terrible. There's no way with your small deformed uterus that you could possibly carry a baby to term, so it would be dangerous for you and the baby. So I recommend adoption. And I did, in fact, go that route and adopted a daughter.
So Alice Eve Cohen, you suddenly find out you're 6 months pregnant. You're 44 years old. On top of that, you had been taking hormones for your condition through the 6 months of the pregnancy so far, and the doctors were concerned that there might be some complications. You're in the hospital and you're looking at the sonogram, and what do you see?
The doctor explained that based on what he saw in the sonogram, the baby was male, but we got a call a couple of days later from the doctor who said, well, it appears that the baby is genetically female and anatomically male, which meant that he anticipated the baby would have ambiguous genitalia. That, in turn, indicated that the baby might have something called chronic adrenal hyperplasia, which is a potentially fatal enzyme disorder. So I imagined a terrible outcome, a terrible scenario, and it was unimaginably painful and frightening.
And you even considered abortion at a certain point.
I did. The only option that was open to me at the time was a late-term abortion in Wichita, Kansas, with the late George Tiller.
The doctor who was murdered.
Yes. And in that terrifying time when I was feeling hopeless about my future and the baby's future and really could see no way out, in fact, was feeling suicidal when I was trying to assimilate all of this information, being given that choice saved my life, and it enabled me to choose to have the baby.
And, I mean, you were worried. I mean, one of the side effects of the DES that your mother had taken when she was pregnant with you was that there was a pretty significant possibility that you would give birth early, very early.
Yes. In fact, you know, way back at the age of 30, when the fertility doctor examined me, he said, you wouldn't be able to carry a baby past 6 months. Well, I found out I was 6 months pregnant, you know, liable to give birth any moment, and therefore was exceptionally careful not to move. I tried to stay as still as possible for the remaining 3 months to protect the pregnancy. And in fact, I did have a full-term birth.
Alice Eve Cohen, you had the minimal amount of health insurance when you were going through this process. What did you learn about the healthcare industry in our country during that time?
I found it, well, in retrospect, I find it almost comical how many errors, how many omissions there were, how inadequate my health insurance was. At the time, it wasn't remotely comical. My insurance company refused to cover any high-risk obstetric care because none of my odd series of problems fit into their customary categories. So I paid for every bit of obstetric care out of pocket, going into tremendous debt. And I think that the way I was shafted by my insurance company is probably very typical of how many Americans feel.
Shortly after you turned 45, you actually gave birth. And, I mean, all of these fears had been building up at that point, the gender ambiguity, the dying in childbirth, the child not surviving. What happened?
Well, you know, the title of the book is What I Thought I Knew. And at that moment in the book, I thought I knew that the baby would be born with genital ambiguity. And, in fact, it seems that it was either a misreading of the sonogram or it might have been a temporary genital enlargement because of the hormones that I was taking. I didn't anticipate what really was happening, which was that my daughter was born with a growth disorder and one leg was shorter than the other, which was at that time an undiagnosable mystery.
And how is your daughter today?
My daughter is fantastic. She just had her 10th birthday. She's super smart. She's got a fantastic sense of humor, and she is a wonderful fiction writer.
And her condition has been improved?
She had a leg-lengthening surgery last year, which was just the most difficult, painful, long procedure. And I don't wish it on anyone, but it did lengthen her leg, and we've been giving a series of sighs of relief as she outgrows some of the earlier challenges.
Has she read the book? I mean, and if she has, what does she make of your talk of abortion or even the fact that eventually you brought a wrongful life suit against the doctor who initially misdiagnosed you?
I'm delighted you asked that question. It was something that my husband and I were very worried about before the book was published. You know, we don't generally believe in censorship, but we were ready to hide the book and send it away to sleepaway camp when the book came out and you know, pretend nothing had happened. But she's too smart for that. So the one condition we gave her was you have to read it when mommy or daddy is in the room because we know you're going to have a lot of questions. So she read the book and she said, good book, Mom. I really liked it. And I said, I'm so glad, but I have to say, Daddy and I were really worried that you'd be upset by the book. Did it upset you at all? And she said, nope, because I knew exactly how everything was going to turn out.
That's Alice Eve Cohen. She's a playwright and theater artist. The story of her unexpected pregnancy is called What I Thought I Knew. Alice Eve Cohen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Toyota recalled millions of its vehicles in the U.S. and Europe last week to fix sticky gas pedals. The problem led to at least 19 fatalities and accidents over the last 10 years. Toyota says it's shipping new parts to factories and dealers to fix the problem, and while they have temporarily suspended sales in the U.S., they haven't suspended advertising. In fact, they've bought full-page ads in 20 major newspapers this morning. John Neff is the editor-in-chief of Autoblog.com. He joins us from member station WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio, to talk about the week's auto news. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
So the situation with Toyota, how did this happen?
Well, that's a really good question, Leanne. And there's actually going to be two congressional hearings in February to try and get to those answers because no one really has the answer right now on how it came to be. There were reports of sudden acceleration in Toyota vehicles for a long time, going back at least a few years. And just late last year, Toyota acknowledged that it could be caused by floor mats, and there was a recall for over 4 million vehicles to fix their floor mats. And then, as you mentioned, just last week, there was another recall for sticky accelerator pedals. So now we have two recalls that can both cause the same thing. And we don't know how we got there, and we don't know how far we're going to go with it, but hopefully there'll be answers within the next month or so.
What will Congress be looking for during those hearings to learn more about this?
Well, I think specifically they're going to want to know when Toyota first learned of these problems and if they had identified the cause of them. Because right now we have reports of sudden acceleration in vehicles that aren't in either recall, which means that, you know, the scope of this may not be yet known.
Hmm. What kind of financial effect is this having on Toyota, or will have?
Well, it's already having a financial effect. In the last week or so, the Toyota stock has gone down about 16.7%. And as you mentioned, when the last recall for the sticky gas pedals happened, Toyota suspended production of the 8 models in the recall and instructed their dealers to stop selling those vehicles until a fix could be found and implemented. So that's lost sales and lost production. Aside from that, we just also found out that Consumer Reports temporarily yanked their recommendation for these 8 Toyota models that are in the recall. And as you know, Consumer Reports has huge influence over car buyers, so that's definitely going to hurt Toyota in the long run as well.
Mm. Have there been any layoffs? Are you hearing news of layoffs?
We haven't heard any news of layoffs yet. You know, Toyota is a very big company and has been very successful in the last 20 years. So I think they have enough cash in the bank to kind of weather this out for a little while. Kind of all depends on how long this stretches out.
There was good automotive news this past week. Ford Motor Company essentially wowed everybody by announcing a $2.7 billion profit for 2009, and that's its first profit in 4 years. How did Ford manage to do that, and do you think it might happen again this year?
Credit has to go to Ford's CEO, Alan Mulally, who has kind of quietly and subtly positioned Ford in a good place and made very good decisions since he took the helm over there. You know, it comes down to developing good products and promoting them well, and Ford has done that. Its Ford Fusion won the Motor Trend Car of the Year and also the North American International Car of the Year. So they're out in front of people's faces with good products, and basically, you know, nothing has gone wrong for Ford in the past year or so, and they're kind of riding a wave. Mm. And yes, I think they'll definitely turn a profit again in 2010. They have another new small car coming out called the Ford Fiesta. They're poised, if gas prices rise, to have a very good product in that segment that'll become popular.
Ford Fiesta, that's not a new line, is it?
There was a Ford Fiesta a long time ago, and they've actually been selling the Ford Fiesta in Europe continually, and we're actually going to be getting the Ford Fiesta that Europeans have. So we've kind of been waiting for some of Ford's really cool European cars to come over to the U.S., and that's going to be the first one that we share with European customers.
And finally, this week, General Motors reached a deal with Dutch sports car maker Spyker. Spyker's going to buy Saab. Do you think Spyker will be able to turn Saab around and make it profitable? What sort of challenges does it face?
Well, they have a huge uphill climb. Probably the biggest is that Spyker is a small company itself. It makes very high-end exotic supercars. So it's overtaking another small niche company in Saab that's very intertwined with General Motors. So it's going to take 3 or 4 years for Spyker to kind of detach itself from General Motors and all of the parts and manufacturing that Saab relies on General Motors for. The real question is what happens when General Motors isn't there to supply all of the parts and the manufacturing that Saab has to have now to keep going.
And since it's literally about a block away from NPR headquarters, any exciting news coming out of the D.C. auto show this weekend?
Well, you know, the D.C. auto show has kind of become the green auto show in the country. So while there aren't many big concept cars that are debuted there, new vehicles, there's a lot of green news that happens. Probably the biggest piece of news is the Department of Energy secretary announcing that Nissan is getting a $1.4 billion loan to help it build an all-electric vehicle called the Leaf in its plant in Tennessee, which will also add 1,300 jobs to the region. So that's good news for people in that area. And also, this is going to be one of the first all-electric vehicles on the market.
John Neff is editor-in-chief of Autoblog.com, and he joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leanne.
You're listening to NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Most of the big banks that receive TARP money, the money the government set aside to help rescue them from collapse, have now repaid that investment. But many taxpayers, the people who provided that cash, are still asking questions. Why is it so hard to get a loan? And why isn't my bank willing to refinance my mortgage? Or why are those same banks now handing out huge bonuses? Well, Michael Parisi, a graphic artist in Santa Cruz, California, was asking himself those very same questions. He'd been trying to refinance his home loan with one of the big banks, but every time he managed to get on the phone with a real person, he says, he had to start from scratch.
It's been this like comedy of errors, essentially. You know, one person doesn't know how to communicate with another person, and I am just a number lost in this sea of numbers. And, you know, I've gotten very, very frustrated. And I just decided that, you know, this is absolutely ridiculous. And I moved my accounts to a local credit union, a nonprofit credit union, Bay Federal here in Santa Cruz, and started a loan application with them, which, by the way, would be finished in 3 weeks. That's the kind of efficiency that the local banks have that these large corporate banks do not have. It's a locally owned business, so you feel like you're talking to people in your community. You don't feel like you're talking to someone who's sort of filtered through some corporate monstrosity that really does not have your best interests in mind. You're actually talking to people who care about you and your and the community at large. It's pretty amazing.
Michael Parisi was inspired to put his money in a local bank in part by a campaign called Move Your Money. It was started by liberal blogger Arianna Huffington, and she's encouraging people who hold accounts in one of the big banks to move that money to a smaller community bank, a bank that wasn't involved in buying toxic subprime mortgages or taking unnecessary risks. And she even commissioned a short film that uses choice clips from the movie It's a Wonderful Life as a kind of metaphor, with George Bailey as the local banker standing up to the big corporate interests.
This rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community.
We stopped into the Independence Federal Savings Bank here in Washington, D.C. the other day. There are just four branches of this bank, and the day we came in, a pleasant smell wafted through the lobby.
On Friday afternoons, we have our popcorn machine running.
That's Bank President Bob Izzard. He says he likes to get to know as many of his customers personally as he can.
We are there when people walk in. When you called to speak to me today, you got me on the phone. I don't think you would get the president of one of the top 10 banks in the country if you tried to.
Izzard worked for big banks in the past, but he says there's something different about being at a community institution.
The local bank in that town cares because having a playhouse, a movie theater, entertainment, restaurants, all those things are the lifeblood of business for that community. And when you start draining all those things away, the bank dies too.
In his State of the Union address last week, President Obama pledged to give smaller banks like Independence $30 billion, money he hopes that could be used to extend more credit to small businesses. Simon Johnson was once the chief economist at the IMF. He's now a professor at MIT, and he says that shifting money from big banks to small ones actually makes good economic sense.
The smaller community banks and credit unions, I would emphasize, often offer a better deal, more fair treatment on credit cards, better terms on your checking account, for example. And a lot of people have not really thought about that. The big banks, the mega banks in our economy, the Citigroups, Bank of America, and so on, have done really bad things to all of us through their misbehavior and through their continued political lobbying that's preventing sensible financial reform. So moving your money is good for the individual person, and it's good from a point of view of the financial system.
But why punish the banks if they have almost all paid back what was essentially an investment by the federal government?
Well, it's not about punishment, Guy. It's just about responsibility. It's about people looking forward and saying, you know, how comfortable am I with the largest six banks in this economy now having total assets, which of course come from their liabilities, which is the money they get from us, total assets over 60% of the size of our economy, 60% of GDP. That's a big banking system that's more concentrated than in the past. The same six banks back in the 1990s were less than 20% of GDP, measured on a comparable basis. How comfortable is anyone listening with the fact these banks are becoming bigger? They're obviously extremely arrogant. They've behaved in a reckless manner before. And now the president himself is telling us that they need to be reined in.
Simon Johnson, you're an economist, and I'm wondering about the economics of this campaign. I mean, sure, there's populist appeal. Many Americans are angry about the bank bailouts. But if we all put, or most of us put our money in community banks and let the big banks collapse, wouldn't we, the American consumer, feel those consequences?
Well, the big banks are not going to collapse. They've been underwritten by the U.S. government, essentially. And that's actually part of our problem. They are, you know, so-called too big to fail, meaning when they get themselves into trouble, they get massive bailouts. And what you want to do is really move the balance of the financial system, move the money away from those banks in a somewhat gradual and responsible manner.
How would the big banks know if customers were actually moving their money because of this campaign?
One thing is customers tell them. A lot of times you have an exit interview and you go in to close the account. And at least anecdotally, we know a lot of people are telling their banks exactly why they're moving. It's not clear the banks care at this point, but I think they will wake up to this sooner or later.
That's Simon Johnson. He's an economist and author of the upcoming book, 13 Bankers. It's about the American financial system. Simon Johnson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Now, before you go rushing out to open an account at your community bank or credit union, you might want to consider what Bert Ely has to say about all this. He's a banking consultant based out of Alexandria, Virginia, and he says there could be hidden costs to making that move.
You know, first of all, they may be sacrificing convenience, service, and price, but it's not that I oppose it so much. I just think the whole idea is ludicrous. If people, for whatever reason, want to move their banking business from a large bank to a small bank, you know, that's their right. But this notion of punishing the big banks in this way, I think, is simply ludicrous. First of all, it's not clear to me what benefit is gained from it. I don't think the big banks are going to suffer enormous losses of customers on this. In fact, they probably won't even notice it because there's a constant turnover of accounts in banks of all sizes.
The president, in his State of the Union address, pledged $30 billion for smaller community banks. How much of an impact will that have?
Well, this would be $30 billion of the so-called TARP monies that would be invested in the small banks. And first of all, many of these small banks do not want to take that investment. Ever since this program has been around, have counseled banks not to take the money unless they absolutely need it.
Why not?
Because of the strings attached to it. And a lot of bankers have found out that these strings are just not worth the price. But the other thing that's important to keep in mind is that most small banks in this country are adequately capitalized. They have ample funds to lend. The challenge they find is finding good creditworthy borrowers. That's why I don't think this particular program is going to have any meaningful impact at all.
If for the average consumer, doing this, moving their money from a big bank to a small bank, is just a psychological victory, what's wrong with it?
Well, it's nothing. You know, there's nothing wrong for it. I mean, this is a free country. People ought to be able to bank wherever they want. I might add that I bank at a community bank that I'm perfectly happy to deal with. I question, number one, how many people will do it. Number two, to what extent we can even measure it. And third, I would question the wisdom of it if someone will end up not being as well served by their bank as they are with a large bank. If I could give an example on that. In many large metropolitan areas, if a family is kind of scattered in terms of where they live is some distance from where they work and where kids go to school, they may actually be better served by one of the large banks that, for instance, has ATMs that these folks can access without charge in all the different places. A community bank, by necessity, is smaller. It doesn't serve a large geographical area.
So let's take a hypothetical example. Say 50% of individual account holders move their money from the largest banks into the community banks. Would there be any kind of overall economic impact?
First of all, if they lost 50% of their individual family customers, it would have a huge impact on those banks. What we would see would be a tremendous shift of business from larger banks to smaller banks. Quite frankly, from the standpoint of the economy, there would be a lot of cost if there was a shift of that great a percentage.
But how would that affect an individual consumer? I mean, you say there are costs that might be associated with it. What kind of costs?
Well, the cost would be to the large banks as they downsize their operations. For smaller banks, there would be a lot of costs and investments required to upsize their operations, and those costs would ultimately get passed through to consumers.
So in essence, what you're saying is that you would just have a reversal of the situation where community banks would then become the big banks.
Well, they would certainly become bigger banks, and I think that one of the concerns that always comes up with a community bank, and that is that it will get to be too big a bank, and as it grows, lose its association with its community and, quite frankly, become very bureaucratic.
Bert Ely is a banking consultant in Alexandria, Virginia. Bert Ely, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Here's a disturbing fact. Studies show that only about 40% of healthcare workers in this country wash their hands as often as they should. So some hospitals are testing new surveillance technologies to monitor their employees' hand-washing habits. From Birmingham, Alabama, Gigi Dubin has more.
The standard protocol in hospitals is for doctors and nurses to wash their hands on the way in to see a patient and on the way out. But that doesn't always happen. They get busy, they forget. Happens to everyone. Even Lindsay Ann Stone, a nurse at Princeton Baptist Hospital in Birmingham.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
How are you feeling today?
Well, it's still pretty severe.
Yes, ma'am. You let us know if you need anything, but we'll be back, okay?
All right.
Wash your hands is a message Stone and her colleagues have heard over and over again.
Through orientation and bulletins that they put up and hand hygiene pamphlets and posters and everything that you can imagine, it's all over.
Stone says she washes her hands a lot. She guesses at least 100 times a day. But hand washing is kind of like exercise. You don't do it nearly as much as you think you do. So hospital administrators installed new devices to track her hand hygiene. With information transmitted wirelessly through a special badge that she wears, they can tell when she entered a patient's room, whether she washed her hands, and whether she washed again on the way out. That information is then recorded and sent to hospital officials. When she first heard about the new system, Lindsay Ann Stone says she had mixed feelings.
I was excited, but to be honest, I was a little nervous, wondering how it was going to directly affect me as an RN.
For one thing, she and her colleagues wondered how this information, a sort of nice and naughty list on hand washing, would ultimately be used. Harvey Nix is the CEO of Preventix, the company that developed the monitoring system at Princeton Baptist. He says it's meant to be more a gentle prod than punitive.
If they're habitually not complying, we could actually send them an email or send them a text message, something that goes to them personally.
Still, most people aren't thrilled about being monitored. So the Centers for Disease Control is trying to gauge how healthcare workers feel about these new devices. CDC epidemiologist Kate Ellingson says they're using focus groups to help tweak the technology. She says they're asking a number of questions.
Not just how do you like it, what do you think of it, but do you see this as something that you would pay attention to that would change your behavior?
Ellingson says improving hand hygiene among healthcare workers has been a real challenge, and that's come at a cost. According to the CDC, healthcare-associated infections kill about 100,000 Americans a year and cost billions of dollars. For NPR News, I'm Gigi Duban in Birmingham.
This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Caves are some of the last places on the planet left to explore. Though caving is relatively safe, if something goes wrong deep inside the earth, a rescue can take days, in part because cell phones and walkie-talkies don't work underground. But now a remarkable teenager in New Mexico has invented a device that may significantly speed the rescue process by allowing cavers to text from deep underground. As Brad Horn reports from Carlsbad, New Mexico, the young man's invention may have other applications as well.
The kid is smart. So smart, he says stuff like this.
I rewrote my receive program and added a noise rejection system that can throw out Navy beacon pulses that get intermixed with my signal. And so that way...
16-year-old Alexander Kendrick won the 2009 International Science Fair for inventing this cave texting device. The award got the teen from Los Alamos, New Mexico, a new computer, a trip to Switzerland, and $12,000 in checks. I wanted to find out why this thing was such a big deal. And the next thing I knew, I was hanging from a rope in the bowels of the earth and groaning under my breath.
God help me.
I was with a team of cavers in Carlsbad Caverns National Park in New Mexico, heading 1,000 feet underground to test Kendrick's invention, which is something like a computer attached to a ham radio. It transmits data using low-frequency radio waves that can penetrate rock more easily than high-frequency transmissions like those in FM broadcasts. If this test succeeded, it would be the deepest known underground digital communication ever to take place in the United States. And why would anyone want to text from nearly 1,000 feet underground? Here's why. In a 1991 New Mexico cave rescue, it took 170 people 4 days to save a woman with a broken leg. The rescue team had to lay miles of telephone line in order to stay in touch with the surface. If they'd had Alex's radio, the rescue time may have been cut in half. That could make the difference between life or death. The other reason this thing is a pretty big deal?
Come and I'll show you the lab.
Science. This is Diana Northup, a microbiologist at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque.
There are some nasty chemicals here in the lab, so don't touch stuff.
Her research lab is full of cave bacteria in petri dishes. Northup tells me that scientists find microorganisms in these deep caves that might have the potential to kill superbugs.
Microorganisms that live in such a low-nutrient environment actually put out antibiotics. They produce them.
But scientists think one of the biggest threats to this emerging source of antibiotics is actually the scientists themselves. People contaminate the sensitive cave environment just by being there. In fact, researchers believe the more they visit the cave, the less likely they are to find antibiotics there. Northup thinks that by connecting data recorders to Alex's radio, scientists could remotely transmit information about the cave environment.
So a cave radio that allows you to beam data to the surface rather than visiting it in person can be extremely valuable. It could save the cave.
Back in the cave, we've arrived at the test spot, exactly 946 feet underground. The radio is being set up on the edge of a big pool of blue-green water pocked with stalagmite islands. It was 68 degrees but incredibly humid. Alex and the team pulled pieces of white PVC tubing from their backpacks and assembled the radio's antenna, which looks like a 6-foot-wide tic-tac-toe frame with wire wrapped around it. His dad, Brian, was about to hike to an identical unit sitting directly above us on the surface.
So now we have 2 hours to get in place.
1 hour and 59 minutes, actually.
Are you getting nervous?
No.
You're making me nervous.
They synchronized their watches, and Brian and another caver climbed the steep, dusty slope above us. And then we waited. 2 hours later, after calibrating the devices, Alex typed the word happy on a rubber keyboard and pushed send. Up above on the surface, his father stared at a small screen, hoping to see the word.
4, 3, 2, 1, here it comes, let's hope. Any second now, he should send us something, let's hope. So we missed the H, but yep. We got appy. That's excellent, we got it. That's digital data coming through at 950 feet, roughly.
Now, Alex has to fine-tune the radio to make it smaller and tougher and easier for rescue crews to get down into caves. That'll have to wait, though, because he's busy working on his 2010 science fair project, a device that finds underground rivers by measuring their electromagnetic currents. I don't know what problem he'll solve next, but I hear there's this thing called global warming. For NPR News, I'm Brad Horn.
And if you want to see photos of Alexander Kendrick's cave radio test, go to npr.org.